You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Ariane Nyer. I'm President Emeritus of the Open Society Foundations, and I'm here as the moderator of this panel. And as moderator, I have said to the panel that I would pose a couple of questions to them and see how the discussion goes, rather than asking them to start with set speeches. And after a period of discussion, we will open it up to questions by the other people who are here today. We have three persons on the panel who are each very knowledgeable about China and about the prospects for democracy and the protection of human rights in China. Starting on my far right, we have Rowena Zhaoqing He, a lecturer on Chinese history at Harvard, and her most recent book is Tiananmen Exiles, Voices of the Struggle for Democracy in China. And next to her is Xiaorong Li, who I have known since she was the first executive director of human rights in China. The organization was actually established a few months prior to Tiananmen Square, and I recall taking part in the founding meeting of the organization in 1988. Xiaorong has been associated with the Institute for Philosophy and Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and she has played a crucial role in assisting from the outside human rights defenders in China. And then sitting next to me is Orville Schell, who directs the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Orville is the former dean of Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and he is, as I think probably everyone here knows, a prolific author of books and articles on China. To start, I wanted to say a few words about what happened or what was happening in 1989 when the events of Tiananmen Square took place. It was a moment in which it seemed that on a worldwide basis, great headway was being made in the struggle for freedom and democracy. There had been shifts in a number of Latin American and Asian countries not long before that. In the early part of the 1980s, most Latin American countries were military dictatorships. By the end of the decade, other than in Cuba, the military dictatorships had all fallen or were falling. The last of them, the Chilean dictatorship of General Pinochet, was in the process of falling in 1989. The general had lost a plebiscite in 1988 and had to give up power in 1990. In Asia, or in some countries of Asia, there had also been transformations. In South Korea, in the Philippines and in Taiwan in the late 1980s. There were significant movements in the direction of human rights and democracy. And change was on the horizon at that point in South Africa. A few months after Tiananmen Square, Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and the end to the apartheid system was signaled by Mandela's release. The one major event that went in the opposite direction was what happened on the night of June 3rd, 4th, 1989 in China. I should say that even that date of June 4th, things went in another direction in one other country, an important country, in terms of its global influence. The same day as the crackdown in China, there was an election in Poland, and the Solidarity Movement won every seat in the same, that is, the Polish parliament that was contested, and 99 out of 100 seats in the Polish Senate, an independent candidate won the 100th seat. So I think that is perhaps indicative of the extraordinary contrast between what happened in China at that moment and what was happening in other parts of the world. In that period, about 1989, I think that one of the factors that contributed to the advance of democracy and human rights worldwide is that the United States in particular had been immensely successful in getting across one idea. And that was the idea that there was a relationship, a direct relationship, between political freedom and economic success. And so I think a lot of those who were engaged in efforts to promote political freedom also thought that as a consequence of those efforts, they would economically improve their own lives. Now here we are 25 years later, and things don't look the same way. I would say that if anything, there have been more reverses recently with respect to political freedom than great successes. Except for Tunisia, things have been turning out badly in the various countries that were the focus of struggles in connection with the Arab Spring. We have seen the consolidation of Putinism in Russia. We have seen the rise and relative success of populist movements, which very often have a racist quality in Europe, and populist movements in Latin America. And we have events confined to a single country, like the recent military coup that has taken place in Thailand. And so it's not an atmosphere in which there is great headway for democracy and political freedom. And we're also at a point where that relationship between political freedom and economic success doesn't look as strong as it seemed in 1989. And of course, China is the main reason for that, because China has had spectacular economic success without significant enhancement in political freedom. And of course, many Western countries in the last several years, which have enjoyed a relatively large amount of political freedom, have had significant economic difficulties in recent years. So one can no longer appeal to people on the basis that political freedom equates or achieves economic success. So the question with which I'd like to start to the members of our panel, and I'm asking this to each of them, and maybe we'll go from Rowena, from you in this direction, and trying to respond to this. How do you see the current situation? Do you see any possibilities of moving towards greater political freedom and democracy in China? Is this a lost cause? Was what happened at Tiananmen Square a death knell for democracy and political freedom, or is there still some prospect that we can move in the direction of democracy and political freedom?
I think that's a great question. It's a very important question, too. It is true that on the surface, Tiananmen seems to be totally invaluable and removed from the reality of the rising China. But if you look at the Tiananmen mothers are still not allowed to openly mourn their children, and the exiles are still not allowed to return home even for their parents' funerals. And scholars who study Tiananmen, they have been regularly banned from getting visa to enter China. So in many sense, Tiananmen did not and in 1989 is ongoing, the detention of the recent intellectuals who organized the symposium on Tiananmen. They were detained for the whole month, and so it just showed us again and again Tiananmen did not end in 1989 was just the beginning of an end. Well, the regime has been very successful in suppressing and manipulating the memory of 1989, but this kind of manipulation has followed with all kinds of distortions, psychological, political, cultural, historical, in the society. So I think it's impossible to understand today's China without understanding the spring of 1989. And generally, and people know it's all the relations between politics and power, Eastern memory, intellectual freedom, and human rights in the Chinese context. Yes, as you mentioned earlier, Deng's policy that to the country, make money whatever way you want, but forget about under politics and religions, has led to economic boom and increase in average living standards and China's rise in the international world. But it happened not without paying a heavy price. You know, profound cynicism in the Chinese society, nationalism of the younger generation, the lack of trust in the society, persistent environmental problems, massive corruption. So all these problems that students tried to fix in 1989 has not been fixed, but it's getting much much worse. So the so-called China rising is at the cost of human lives and human dignity. So the moment the government tells these people that human lives, human dignity, human decency can be sacrificed for economic development and stability, they basically were sending the message that any kind of principles can be compromised for the sake of a rising China for economic development. I think that's the root for all social political problems in China today. So economic development will not come without a cost. And get back to the question about whether another tenement would happen again, or if there's any potential political change, I think yes and no. No in the way that, you know, Tiananmen in 1989, people, students, did not take to the street looking for regime change. They were not trying to overthrow the government. So it's not a real sense of revolution, let's put it this way. So it's more out of passion, out of even trust in the regime, in the government, that they would not suppress the movement. But I think if another Tiananmen happened again, another large-scale social movement happened again, it would be out of grievances, out of frustration, out of hatred. It would not be out of idealism. It would not be out of love and trust and passion as it was in 1989. Although there are all this repression happening, I think Sharon can probably follow up with more information. Many of the Tiananmen veterans, they have been active, both those high profile, like Liu Xiaobo, who is now in prison, or the low profile people, quietly working for NGOs inside and outside China. They have been trying to push for change as well. But I'm not optimistic about civil society development because of the lack of some of the very basic prerequisites: free speech, free access to information, free press. So all these things are still, you know, not present in the Chinese society, and I think civil society forces development continue to be difficult and challenging. My final note is, Tiananmen may remind us of the depression, but it also symbolizes people's power and human spirit. As the desire for freedom is deeply human, and the longing for basic rights is universal. I'm sure history will witness the Tiananmen spirit as the power of the powerless again and again. Thank you.
Sean?
Ari, you prove once again you're the master of steering up a brainstorm. You know, for since Tiananmen in the past quarter of century, a great political scientists in this country, politicians, lawmakers have been debating on this issue whether democracy, political freedom, would be the fruit of market economic development, as you remarked that China has done spectacularly economic development, but we don't see an improved political environment for freedom. We don't even now see a great prospect for political legal reform at this point. You know, I noticed in the room there are quite a few people recently coming here from mainland China, either to get away from political persecution or the environment there is so unbearable. They need a moment of freedom to come out. They can, maybe during the question answer set time, they can speak about the current situation in China. But you know, you're all familiar with, from reading newspapers and New York Times, what the situation is now. I think, you know, we don't need to remind you of the cases. You know, just basically, the situation is grim. It's unexpectedly harsh political repression under the new Xi Jinping regime. People had some expectations that he would liberalize somehow when he came to power. But on the contrary, ever since he got into office, it has been one after another political crackdown with unprecedented many more numbers of criminal detentions, disappearances.
Sure, let me interrupt you on that. When you say there's been one crackdown after another, I mean, that can also mean, though, that he senses a need to engage in those political crackdowns. That is, that there are possibilities of dissent which need to be suppressed, and that he is engaged in crackdowns because he doesn't feel secure, or the government doesn't feel secure without engaging in those crackdowns. So you can see that on the one hand as you know, a very negative development, but you can also see it as indicating that he has some reason to be concerned about political dissent.
Well, you're reading my mind, that's what I'm going to say. In fact, given all these green developments, I'm optimistic. I think the economic development has not so far delivered political freedom and democracy, but we are very hopeful. The precise reason for that is because as Xi Jinping is feeling now the insecurity. Why? Because civil society is all, you know, awake in China, and they're very active. So 25 years ago, compared to today, there's so many activists who are willing to be out there, to be outspoken. And right now, even today, there's a hunger strike going out outside a prison in Zhengzhou, Henan province, by more than 20 lawyers who are protesting the blocking by police of their right to visit their clients. You would not imagine this being happening in China. And the news is minute by minute on Weibo, on Twitter. So in a way, Chinese citizens already have a broke open space for themselves to express themselves. There's a lot more space for information freedom, for speech. Government can continue to crack down, can continue to be repressive and even more repressive in some ways. But this is precisely a reflection of their insecurity because they felt threatened. They're threatened not only because there are so many problems in China they have to deal with, as Ms. He mentioned, it's not just corruption, and precisely because of the economic development, and because of the lack of elected representatives of the people, and people have no outlet to complain about problems, about injustice. Today's China is very much like a volcano that's waiting to explode. There are so many problems that do not find the official permitted outlet, so they are burning like right underneath the surface. You're just waiting for some crack. It's going to flare. And it's a matter of time. So we should all be very optimistic. And I think to a very large extent, thanks to the Chinese citizens themselves, I think the hope, the optimism should come from our belief in human nature. Every human being is for freedom, is for human dignity. When those things are being suppressed, are being violated, they will turn into a freedom fighter. Through my work, I have come into contact with so many ordinary people. They were either not even being a toddler 25 years ago, or they had nothing to do with the politics. And today, they're in the forefront. I mean, I just have to give you one example of one individual. Her name is Cao Sunli, who recently died in detention. She wasn't a Tiananmen student leader or protester. And her problem started with some housing problem with her working unit. She felt there was injustice in assigning housing. So she started writing letters, she started to complain, and then every step she come up with suppression. You can't express your view, you cannot disclose corruption, you cannot sue your officials at your working unit, you cannot get the journalist to report on you. Then she went to court, they don't accept her case. So then she discovered a whole, you know, a host of legal injustice issues and how the whole system, the legal system is corrupt, is intervened, manipulated by the party single-handedly. And then she became this humorous defender. What was she doing last year in June? She was organizing a protest in front of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Why? Because the Foreign Affairs Ministry is representing Chinese government at the UN to undergo universal periodic review. She figured there's no channel for me in China to bring up injustice. I'm going to go to the UN. This is my opportunity. So she organized this thing, and then we invited her to Geneva to attend some preparation sessions for the review, and she was detained at the airport, put in detention. She got very sick and she died in detention. So this is a woman, right? So she should give us hope. Of course, it's a very sad case, but she gave me a lot of hope, and I came into contact with so many people like her. Some of them are here, and I hope you can meet them. I spotted some of them. They should give you hope. They were not political dissidents, and they were not like Liu Xiaobo and not Xu Ziyong, but they were those ordinary people. It's them in the thousands, even I would say millions. They are just, you know, they are out there, very outspoken, they're getting involved in general human rights issues, legal injustice issues, political reform. So I can get, you know, I think it's a dissertation topic whether economic success should be like causing a chain, causal effect, chain to deliver democracy. That's a theoretical issue. I think it's a very complicated issue in the theoretical sense. There are many other things that should happen in between. One of them is the civil society activism, is how the people themselves realize the system is corrupt to the core and need to be overthrown. And that, I think, is happening in China. The delivery is not direct. Economic success, democracy, no. There are many things that need to happen in between, but I see some of the things that are happening in between. So democracy is on the horizon for China, in short.
Well, it's nice to have. Can you hear me all right? If I don't use this, it just sounds like I'm on another planet. I think. It's nice that you end on a note of optimism, Sharon. I myself am a little bit undecided in that question. I do think 1989 was an extraordinary moment in many ways. But I think it was an inflection point, as Arya suggests, that really it was the beginning of the end of history, in effect. Because at that time, there were so many things happening which made it look as if Francis Fukuyama, remember him? The game was over. We had won. The forces of history ineluctably were leading towards openness. And there's a great tradition of this in Western political, philosophical tradition, you know, from Hegel to Marx to on and on and on, that history has emotion. And here it was being acted out before us in the grandest way all across the world as the Soviet Empire was crashing and burning. One piece at a time. It's interesting, Arya, I called up a friend who, you know, a Polish woman, to see if she wanted to come today, and she said, what's it about? And I said, June 4th, and she said, oh, it's about Poland. I said, no, it wasn't. But in any event, in those days, and I remember vividly spending weeks in Tiananmen Square when this was unfolding, it seemed just the sort of the natural, inescapable forces of history were at work. It seemed that there was no way that this genie would ever be put back in the party bottle. Everybody felt that. There wasn't a single person of the many millions who came into the square, I think, who thought, well, you know, this too will pass. And will return to the ancien regime. Nobody. And yet it happened. And I think when that happened, that did throw off a whole sort of a bunch of assumptions that we in the West had made. And you all have said a little bit about this, that, you know, you just Remember the grand old wonderful days when just let the New York Stock Exchange and market capitalism in and the rest would follow? And it didn't. And we're in an anomalous position where all of our sort of philosophical assumptions have hit a brick wall where not only didn't it happen, but China turns out to be the poster child for economic development. Startling, arresting success in many, many ways, the problems notwithstanding, with no political openness at all. What happened? Where were all our developmental theories that turned out, at least for this interim, to seem to have it all wrong? Now, okay, this may be an interim, Xiaorong going forward, maybe the forces of freedom and democracy are irrepressible and history will start up again somehow and China will get on track and, you know, we'll have phase two, three, four. But whatever phase we're in now, no, not at all. And not only has China succeeded in finding a totally different path of development, counter to all of the models which we esteemed, we took for granted, but now it also is becoming something of a model for other people, to wit, I think, Russia. Very envious. And we're on the precipice, I think, of having a different kind of a Cold War, not communism versus capitalism, but the aggrieved nations of the world. The nations of the world who were deprived of their empires and have a kind of a sense of phantom loss and want to restore their sort of imprint in the world of their own old sort of imperial territorial footprint, we may see China and Russia finding some common ground there, even though they don't like each other very much in many, many other ways. So there are a lot of strange things happening where I think common assumptions about how the world moves, how development works, what works, have really come a cropper, and China has been at the very center of all of this sort of these requirements that we reorganize our brains as to what works, what logically follows what, and what, in fact, is the motion of history, of course, which was sort of born of the Enlightenment, where it just seemed inevitable that things grew towards more openness. I mean, Hegel sort of said it in this very complicated way, and we've never quite been able to escape that set of presumptions. So for me, China is a very confusing and a very anomalous case. I know it's a tense place. I live it every day. I don't know how long they can continue this balancing act. I totally distrust my ability to judge it, because at no time over the last 20 years did I think the place would cohere and manage to keep rolling forward as it has. I thought it was fundamentally unstable. Didn't make sense to me. It was counterintuitive. And yet, here we are. Final thought. I do think that in a very strange, again, counterintuitive, somewhat cryptic way, that not only was 1989 the end of political reform in China, when you look back on it, you can say, well, you know, they had a lot of incredibly powerful reformist sentiment, Zhao Ziyang, not the least of it, party secretary, former premier, who was then put under house arrest. But that shock, that fright, scared the Communist Party right back into its most retrograde mode of operations, where it couldn't contemplate political reform, as it had very actively in the 1980s. Very actively. And it had one other interesting effect. If it couldn't reform politically, what could it do besides becoming North Korea? Well, it could reform economically. And I think the shock of 1989 made Deng Xiaoping sort of really go up on his mountain and come to the conclusion that without some extraordinarily dynamic, new, bold economic reform program, perhaps a program they never would have succeeded in implementing before 1989, the party and he were goners. And I think it was that recognition that something very bold, quite extreme, and he said it. You know, he came right out a few days after the massacre, and he said, you know, reform is not dead. He also said, this is a storm that was bound to happen. And he was very much a Leninist. The party remains a very Leninist structure. That means it gets along by controlling. And I think that's going to be the modus operandi going forward, control. And if it doesn't work, the party now has another great source of fund of credit on its side. That is, every other springtime around the world, as Aria pointed out, with exception possibly of Tunisia, has crashed and burned in mad chaos. Exactly what the party warns against. And so who wants to risk going there? We now have a laboratory full of experiments of springtimes everywhere that of late at least have not succeeded. Poland again would be quite an exception. So there are lots of reasons why I don't think we're going to have a tremendous change. And now whether the system just gets too brittle and gets shaken apart by all of its contradictions, that's another question I can't answer. I thought it wouldn't cohere 10 years ago, but it did. And are we off to a new model? I don't know. So far, it's been a model that certainly has problems, but I think you would have to say it's had its successes, quite arresting successes. So where does that leave us? Where does that leave the notion that democracy is the end game of history? Democracy is something so fundamental, and freedom is so deeply rooted in every individual's yearning, that in the end, it will out. Will it? I remand my remaining time to Lee Chowroom for an uplifting message from the other side.
Before you respond to that, I think all three of you have focused on internal dynamics as the driving factor in determining whether there will be any change. If one thinks back to 1989, we used to think in those in that period that external influences had a big role in determining such matters. And Sharon, by your efforts to publicize what happens to rights defenders in China, in effect, you are still suggesting that knowing about this outside and generating some kind of response outside is an important factor. And I wonder if I could get you, not in any order, whoever wants to respond to this, to indicate whether you think what is done externally is significant with respect to these matters in China.
I think it's very significant. I think the international...
I think you may want to use the...
powers to be, whoever they are, should do their best to put pressure on the Chinese government. Just a point that's not a side point, like the great China scholar, as great as always, Perry Link, would like to say, there's no one China. So when we say what China is going to do, we're talking about the Chinese government. And even within the government, we're talking about the reformers, the you know, hardliners, you know, it's very layered. And then we're talking about civil society and the Chinese intellectuals and the Chinese lawyers. So there are mainly many players within China. It's hard to say. I agree what Ovo had just said is very much the thinking of the Chinese government wanted to be the model. And a lot of other governments, in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, have wanted to emulate the model. So it is, in that sense, it is a model now. But where does that leave us? Where does that leave the rest of China, other than what the government is thinking is doing? I just want to get a little bit complicity into here, because international pressure is very important. I think somebody is got to review the reverse of the U.S. policy in 1992 to restore China's most favored nations trade status. I think the major thinking at the time was economic development is a great thing, and hopefully democracy will come in train. And also the other argument is we don't want to hurt the Chinese people because the economic sanction will hurt them. Of course, you know, the government is very capable of transfer the suffering to the people. But then you look at the world as a whole. In many countries, economic sanctions have brought in political changes. So how do we think about that? I mean, I'm not going to answer that question. I think in a way, the economic development did not just, it's not just a great thing, right? It's a complicated thing because it created, because of this kind of government, this kind of political system, it has created such an unjust society today. And so in a way, isn't that a disaster? You know, should we ask ourselves that question? And also the idea that the government has, or Deng Xiaoping has lifted millions out of poverty. I mean, this is another myth. In fact, a few years or a decade before Deng Xiaoping actually said let's go, there have been so many efforts at the bottom of the society pushing for economic reform. And then many places had experimented in the market economic model. And so in a way, the hardworking Chinese, the Chinese who are so resourceful, so are willing to work under such harsh conditions, no union rights, no freedom of expression, no freedom of association, and the corrupt officials sitting on top of you, they brought about the economic miracle in China. So again, this is another mess we can go into in details, but what I'm trying to say is we should reevaluate what we did in 1992 or back then we lifted the sanctions against China because of the Tiananmen massacre. I'm not saying, you know, economic development is a bad thing. I'm saying it's a complicated thing. In a way, as awful, I think I heard you saying, the wealth, the tremendous amount of wealth created first benefited the authoritarian state. Look at their military budget. Look at their internal security budget for internal suppression. You know, all this also benefited from economic development. And today, you know, anyone here just came from China can tell us how every minute when they're in China, they are being under surveillance. There's cameras everywhere. The police stationed outside their houses, you know, activists, they all have a police cars escorting them everywhere they go. So all this takes money. Where does that money come from? In a way, I just want to suggest, in some ways, the international lack of action, in some ways, have raised the kind of police state we have today in China. But then, of course, there are still many other things that we could still do. I don't want to get into too many details, take too much time, but I just want to say, right now, there's a bill that has been proposed in Senate by Senator McCain and Senator Cardin. So it's bipartisan. It's called the Global Act for Human Rights Accountability. It's modeled on the Malinsky Act that was passed in Congress in late 2012. This anti-corruption activist, another activist, a businessman, died in prison in Russia. So Congress passed this bill, it's a law now, to ban Russian abusers of human rights on visas to visit this country and to freeze their bank account that the U.S. government can get hands on. So now there's a movement, there's a move, not a mint, in Congress to try to get this global bill passed to ban all human rights abusers from all countries, including China, on those two, visa sanction and the financial sanction. So if you all have the opportunity to support that bill, that would be a great thing. It's a very good international action to do.
Orville or Rowena, you want to comment on this question of whether external pressure can be a significant factor?
Yeah, of course. I'm very interested in those comments. I think I'm a short-term pessimistic but long-term optimistic about the situation. I think if you look at any historical events, especially after Arab Spring, you'll see that before it happened, people would tell you it's impossible, but the next day when it happened, everyone is telling you that's inevitable. I think if you look at history, that's what happened. That's why I'm still long-term optimistic but short-term pessimistic. Regarding Xiaoyong's comments, I agree with Xiaoyong too about economic development. If you look at between 1989 and 1992, before Deng Xiaoping's sudden tour to Shenzhen, economic was in a mess. So the kind of justifications that the regime has been making about if it had not been for this military crackdown, there would not be the economic development afterwards was not true, because between 1989 and 1992 was totally a mess. That's why he went all the way to the southern part, Shenzhen, to give this speech, let's forget about ideology and focus on money making. So that's another point. And the third thing, international pressure definitely is very important. I think I myself is the beneficiary of this kind of international pressure and attention and focus, because I remember clearly right after 1989, I was still struggling in darkness as a young girl, wondering if the world knew what happened to us and if they care about what's going on. And the only encouragement or light I saw was when I heard the news that when the international community, international society was doing something and saying something. I think those are the kind of light that kept me going and survived 1989, all those years. So I do think that it's very important. I still remember when Liu Xiaobo was giving the Nobel Peace Prize, I was really jumping and celebrating with all my friends. It's not that much about the prize, but it's an international recognition that you had guns, you had tanks, you had propaganda machines, we had nothing, but now we got some international support and recognition for this man that you have put in prison. So it's that kind of support. And I think in the past 25 years, we saw that the mainstream has gone somewhere else. Immediately after the crackdown, the international community have all the support for the cause, for the movement, for democratization in China. But in the past 25 years, you saw we become some very lonely group, small number of group, and I, for this reason, I really appreciate that you're still here caring about this instead of just being fascinated by this China model. They have money and they're successful. I think in a sense the world has become victims of the Tiananmen massacre. Why do I say that? Because I think nowadays very so often we just consider a great country, a powerful country, as one that's only about GDP. And the word, the people, is bounding to this power because of its wealth only. And this power has been enforcing all of these forced values, not just on the Chinese society, but on the international community. I think if we do all these things, we also compromise our values and downgrade our institutions when we forget who we are and stick to our values and principles. So I think in this sense, we are also also victims of Tiananmen, and I do not think this is just about China, it's also about the world. By the end of the day, in this international, global village, we are all on the same plane. A powerful, non-democratic regime that manipulated nationalism is really dangerous to the world, not just to China. I feel like we are on the same plane. If you're being hijacked by some guys, whether you're in a business class, first class, or you're in have a window seat, actually you're going to end the same way. So that's another reason that we really need to care about what's going on in China. It's not just about China, it's really about us. Of course, it also reflects who we are as human beings, as we're citizens. If we can just watch this happen with folded arms and say that they have their own way, and we can forget about those big words like democracy, freedom, whatsoever. You don't have to have a PhD to understand whether the Tiananmen murders need to be given justice if their kids were killed for 25 years. This is just very basic human instinct. And I think the worst thing that the regime has been doing in the past 25 years is not that much about the suppression of history, but more about the twisting of the values. I think the Chinese society now has been so very much receptive to all that kind of rationale that for the sake of this higher goals that we can sacrifice anything, we can sacrifice some of the very basic things that our society used to believe to be important and hold on to. And that's the worst part of it. And that's where cynicism is rooted in the Chinese society, because Chinese intellectuals learn ever since the Great Crackdown that I cannot afford to love this country, this nation, this people. All that I could afford to love is money. That's the message they send to the intellectuals, and that's where cynicism and the silence of Chinese intellectuals in the whole 90s. But of course, as Xiaoyong mentioned, that many of the rights activists have started to push back. But it's been a war. It's been a war of memory against forgetting. It's been a war between the power and the powerless in the past 25 years. And international community support is definitely important.
Well, maybe just one very quick thought. I do think, in my experience, there are few countries of consequence more sensitive to how the world views them than China. And I think here, because of the unique sort of historical experience, the United States has played a rather dominating role. So it is of great importance whether the United States respects China. And this is something that the government really deeply wants. On the other hand, I would have to say, in thinking about pressure, that now that China is much stronger, it is much more inclined to resist pressure. So that pressure, while it is certainly heard and it certainly has an effect, very often will induce the opposite reaction from that which is desired, simply because China does not, the party does not want to seem to be yielding to pressure. So it's a paradox.
Yeah. You know, Rowena mentioned Liu Xiaobo, and one very small indication of the way China cares about the international reaction, I thought, was that the 11-year prison sentence on Liu Xiaobo was imposed on Christmas Day so as to minimize the international reaction to that prison sentence. China, I think, doesn't fear economic pressure from any place else. Nobody's really in a position to put economic pressure on China. And I think China has been the first country that has turned things around. That is, it uses its economic pressure to prevent others from speaking out about China. If a government wants to sponsor a resolution in the UN critical of China on human rights grounds, then China indicates that it will employ economic reprisals against the government that joins some effort to criticize China.
Or a journalist, or a scholar, or a businessman.
Yes. But even so, they don't want the criticism that comes from something like the very harsh prison sentence against Liu Xiaobo. I teach a course on human rights, and one of the things I have said to my students, and I wonder if you agree with this or you think I'm completely off base, I've said that I thought that if tomorrow one lifted all restrictions on the formation of human rights groups in China and there were no reprisals, there would easily be the largest human rights organization in the world that would emerge in China. That that it is really the government's capacity to intimidate that prevents anything like that from taking place, rather than a lack of interest in human rights. And I wonder whether you you agree with that or disagree with that.
I agree.
Okay.
So, if they left any restrictions on human rights organizations, then there will suddenly be thousands of such organizations. They are already operating, that's the people I work with, right? So they don't call themselves human rights organizations. They don't get legally registered. They even work underground, but they're there. And so now suddenly if the restriction is lifted, somebody here actually can answer that question better. So there will be, I can say immediately, thousands of such organizations.
I agree with Sharon that if the, without this kind of fear, then definitely there will be lots of people trying to take to the street. And also, I think public opinion is pertaining democratization and nationalism is inseparable from the collective memory of the nation's most immediate past. And that's why Tiananmen has been such a contested field in the past 25 years. And getting back to rights activists, I think the regime has learned two things in the post-Tiananmen period. One thing is that they try to frame these people who have been trying to work with overseas NGOs and that they are anti-China forces. So everything, whatever people try to start, and they would say that they're working with anti-China forces. So the military crackdown was an effort to countering anti-China the conspiracy to weaken and divide China. And afterwards, anyone who tried to push for democratization in China, they become part of the anti-China forces. And this is closely related to the nationalism phenomenon in the post-Tiananmen period of the younger generation. I think the regime learned that they are more sophisticated in dealing with history and memory. So on one hand, they wanted to make sure those who have experienced Tiananmen, they wanted to make sure that they remember this. They know that if you do this again, this will be the consequences. And for the younger generation, they make sure that they do not know anything about it. If they do know much about it, then it will be the official version about the events. And at the same time, starting from 1992, they implemented this patriotic education campaign that I had studied in all the textbooks. I analyzed the textbooks. So all the textbooks in particular, history and political education textbooks, has been significantly revised to underscore the patriotic theme and also China's humiliation and victimhood in its relation with the West. That's why the younger generation grew up with all this kind of beliefs. For example, China is specific socio-political historical culture context. That's why we cannot have Western democracy, and the U.S. always used human rights issues to criticize China and to weaken China. So those kind of arguments has been also been prevalent in the Chinese society, and when we talk about human rights, when we talk about beliefs in the directions that China is heading towards, that also has a lot to do with how the history and memory of Tiananmen has been presented and interpreted in the Chinese society. And again, as I mentioned at the very beginning, public opinion pertaining to democratization and nationalism is just inseparable from the nation's most immediate past. The collective memory of the most immediate past, whether it's selective, manipulated, or truthful memory. So I think that is also connected to people's idea about democratization in China.
Good. Well, let me now open this up to questions. Lenny?
Thank you, Aurier. Aurier asked about external influences, and I'm curious to what extent one of those external influences might be some of the failures of the liberal democratic model. It strikes me that the sort of debate around Western human rights versus so-called non-Western approaches to human rights is not a significant debate anymore. It's actually a much more empirical question. When one looks at the polarization, say, of the American political system today, despite the jettisoning of Eric Cantor yesterday, still very polarized. When one looks at what came out of the European Parliament two weekends ago with respect to far-right parties, I think it's not difficult for the Chinese government to point to these examples and simply say, this is what you want, or would you prefer to have far more effective means-ends approaches to getting politics done? And it's a very strong and convincing argument. No?
You know, once Deng Xiaoping, before he died, I can't remember his exact wording, but he wondered out loud why Americans wanted to have three governments, namely the judiciary, legislative, and administrative branches, within one government, all checking and obstructing each other, because he said, how could you ever get anything done? And he was prescient in his critique of the inability of a democracy to function in an efficient way. And Chinese do indeed now look at the United States just as they look at the various spring times. And it's another example in the wrong column for democracy. So right now, I would say that quite apart from their own success, it isn't as if democracy is exactly the shining city on the hill that it once was, as an example.
Well, I think there are two fundamentally different questions, right? One is how to improve democracy itself. Democracy or non-democracy is not a matter of efficiency. It's about something about participation, about respecting every individual's opinions, how our society should be governed. So that issue is not resolved in China. And the American democracy system is not the most efficient one, and it's different from the British one, the French one. You know, all those differences are on a different plane, right? So we accept the fundamental principle that every citizen's opinions should count, but we need to work out how to do that. That's a different methodological issue. But for China, is using this argument to counter any kind of development, democratization, is a different matter. It doesn't work. It's logically, it's not because it's inefficient, it doesn't mean you can deprive every individual's right to political democratic governance, right? So anybody, you know, all the Democrats in China are very familiar with this argument. Whenever it's brought up by the government, they say, well, you can't use this as an excuse to deny us the right to political participation.
Yes. They can be citizenship without democracy, but they cannot be democracy without citizenship participation. I think if the government keep punishing people who participate, who actively participate, then it's not going to work. And again, regarding U.S.-China policy and the inference, I think we witnessed a period of time when the government, the U.S. government, together with the world, seemed to think that, okay, doing business is more important, money making is more important. I fully understand that kind of political pressure and the you know, the pressure from very immediate about national interest and everything. But it seems to me any kind of relationship, I do not need to be an IR person to understand, should be two-way relationship. Even if the Chinese government doesn't want any criticism, want to hear any criticism, it doesn't mean that we should just mute our criticism. I think it's very important that we express and let the government know what we stand for, what our values are, because that's what the United States is about. And it cannot be, okay, you're making more money and we should just stop criticizing you. And I think, of course, that I saw some adjustment in this kind of trend recently, and I think we should really stick to the values, as you already eloquently put it, like it's more about making sure that everyone's right is protected. It's not just about efficiency. And again, as I mentioned earlier, if you just look at the numbers, you just look at the GDP, even for that, it's at a cost of all these other human costs, environmental costs. It's not as efficient as we thought it is. There's a Chinese saying, 成语, called 拔苗助长. You push the plant, it's growing higher, but it loses its root. It's not going to grow anymore. It just looks like you have a plant, you pull it out, and then it looks taller for the time being, but actually it lost the root. It's not going to grow anymore. So it's not sustainable, it seems to me, like what's going on is not sustainable. Of course, people also, like China also say that, look at Taiwan, they even fight, politicians fight with each other, so democracy doesn't solve any problem, and I disagree, and I think, in fact, Taiwan can provide China a very good model. Taiwan has something very similar to Tiananmen, as many of you know, the Arab incident, I mean, Nida incident. The KMT, the Nationalist Party, they cracked down the protesters, and then they imprisoned all those participants, and Chen Shui-bian was one of those that was in prison. But in the 1980s, when Jiang Jingguo felt that they have all this, you know, pressure from below, they really need to have a political reform. Otherwise, even the KMT, the party, could not survive. So they decided, okay, let's open up, let's have free press, let's have free speech, let's allow opposition parties, let's release political prisoners. And that's the first step when Taiwan started to have this free first step of democratization. And yes, KMT lost its power to the DDP at one point, lost to Chen Shui-bian. But look at who's in power now. It's the KMT again, right? It's Ma Ying-jeou again. So losing up, opening up, learning to lose in order to win again. So this kind of rationale has been an alternative presented to the CCP regime, I mean to the Communist Party regime for a long time. And if they are willing to take this as a deal, I'm not imagining they're going to be good guys. I just think that this would be a good rationale for them to consider, because that actually would probably be the best for the party and for the Chinese society if they open up and have political reform. Because what is happening now is not sustainable. So just for the sake of the party's survival, it's actually better for them to have the real reform and to open up.
Viktor Shatinsky.
My question is basically related only partly to China. I have a big problem with long assumed or long accepted connection between economic development and open society and democracy. I don't know of any country that developed under democracy and open society. Never in history. Only when some countries in Western Europe and the United States were already developed, and there were conditions after World War and unions, etc., they could make this combination, but not in the 18th, 19th century development of Europe, not under communists, not in any other case of development. Development always was under duress, under regime, under control, with the lack of freedom and with big, I will use, you know, not popular word, exploitation. So I think that China here is another, slightly another example, because the reforms, and I'm old enough to remember that, the reforms under communism and communist economy that were going from the 58-59 with Leontief in Russia had actually to develop communist economy by splitting big conglomerates and by taking away the party central economic power on the top and put it down and introduce some competition. And that was politically difficult because the those who had power were resisting that and didn't want it. But once the communist economically was overthrown, either in Poland in 1989 or in China after 1989, then it is a completely different thing, because capitalism actually at that stage doesn't necessarily need political reform and political freedom. In Poland, it was difficult for Balcerowicz because we were already under freedom, because our transition was at the same time to market and freedom. That's why we needed shock therapy and actually the cushion, and that was support was short-lived. But in China, actually, it opened the way to that. So that means that the changes that were there for economics were not nothing against the historical tide or general against the tide. But that brings me to Arya's second question about the international influence. And I think that when any country historically developed enough that the distribution could be changed, including the distribution of influence through political reforms, then it could have happened only in the conditions of internal pressure. And now if you have what you are saying, you are alluding to the possibilities for internal pressure in China, that economy, external forces are extremely important to keep morale of those who can rebel or who can resist or who can ask for reforms from inside. That is the main, the top, including the sanctions. Probably sanctions in my country under 1980s economically were actually wounding the population, but politically were very important because that was the support for the opposition, that they didn't give up and they pressed for reforms. And I think that a lot of what open society is doing in closed societies is precisely doing that, supporting the small islands of dissatisfaction and potential changes.
You want to comment? There wasn't really a question, so.
Well, I want to say consistently, every Chinese former political prisoners I have met, I ask the question, did it help international pressure? They all said, yes, it helped. And they gave me all kinds of examples how it helped. And then for all the activists in China who are now facing all sorts of harassment from the government, whenever something happened, they always ask for international pressure. So in a way, of course the government won't like it, and precisely how do we know that? They have done all this stuff to, you know, their spokesperson for their state council, for the foreign minister would come out with a statement whenever the U.S., the EU, the UN does anything, right? And then they will have long articles in the official newspaper to counter the argument, and they will expose the your own institution for supporting activists in China or the National Endowment for Democracy because they don't like it, because it hurts them. That's why we should do it. So they mind, they care about it. It's all about face. They will fight back. But the fact is all the pressures made some difference at some level. I can go into a lot of details if you're interested. I'm thinking as my retirement project to write about it. Even at the UN, you think the UN is the most useless organization. But when the UN does something, something happens. Happens in China, not only because Chinese government will come out with a statement and being very angry, but they actually been changing their law. There are many examples. You know, the criminal procedural law, the criminal code has been changed on articles concerning torture. You know, we don't know this, right? But this is happening. Why? Because the Committee Against the Torture in the past, how many years? China ratified the treaty in 1988, has persistently pressured China to change its law on very specific articles. For example, re-education through labor. China said it's abolishing it, right? Because every time the UN Committee Against the Torture raised that issue as how it violated the torture convention. So things are changing, not as visible, but international pressures like this sort, you know, do help. So I'm very positive of this.
It seems to me there are two things we're talking about here. The one is, what is justice in relation to people who dissent and would like to speak openly and have free expression? The other is the question of development. You know, what's national, what promotes national development? How do you make an economy stronger? And these things do not necessarily draw from the same well.
Tom, and then over there.
Just a quick question about, I think all of the panelists at different moments in time and using different words talked about the struggle of memory against forgetting. And I'm reminded that Louisa Lin, the NPR journalist who recently wrote a book on Tiananmen, did an experiment where she took the famous picture of the so-called tank man, the one individual standing in front of three tanks on the road to Tiananmen Square in the immediate aftermath of the crackdown. She took that photograph to students at Beijing University and asked them simply, what is this? And the vast majority of them were unable, and perhaps some percentage of them were unwilling to answer. So my question for all of you is, what sense do you have of what level, especially among young people, that the battle has been won by the party, that many people have no idea what happened in April, May, and June of 1989, what number of people have maybe even experienced it and have chosen to forget about it, to no longer really think about it, what level of remembrance have you seen, especially outside of activist circles? You know, what is your sense of the current historical resonance inside China of 1989?
It's my question. Thank you. I've been written about this. So I think that the Tank Man picture, actually there's a documentary called Tank Man, right? So that was produced about 10 years ago, and they invited four Beijing University students, asking them if they have any idea about what that was done. And I think they all said no at that time, but some of them were kind of whispering to each other as well, so we do not know. So that actually tells you a lot, because we actually did not know who was behind the scene when they were shooting the documentary, and I think that's the post-Tiananmen scenario. So maybe you know about something, but you have to tell yourself that I do not know, or I do not care. That's almost like a survival technique for people. And for the younger generation, they probably, it is true that they either do not know anything about it, or they feel that this has nothing to do with me. Even if it happens, so what? So it's this kind of so what question that tells you a lot about how successful the impact, combining both historical amnesia and nationalistic sentiments in the society has been. So I myself have been teaching the Tiananmen course for 4 years now, right? So teaching to students both in the United States and from China. And I think maybe one scene is also very telling, right? When we had a conference this year on April 26th, I invited two Tang men to my conference. One Tang man was the photographer who shot that Tang man picture. The other Tang man was the real Tang man, Fang Zheng. He was the guy who ran over by a tank on the morning of June 4th, losing his two legs. His two legs were crashed. And they were both at the site, at the conference. And one of my Chinese students, the only Chinese student who was willing to participate at the conference, you know, others did not want to be part of it because of the fear that they would get punished. And the only student who were willing to do it, she did not want to come up to the stage when she asked the question. So it was this eyewitness of a major historical event in China, and a Chinese student in the audience who did not dare to come up to ask questions. And we were all speaking in our second language or through translation in a foreign land, talking about a major historical event in China. And inside the country, the younger generation did not even get any opportunity to learn about it. So that was really a telling moment that tells you everything about what Tiananmen is about. And people are punished, right? People are still punished. And so many Chinese students told me, I cannot come to your conference because I don't want to be hucha, right, to be invited for tea. And I did not want to be punished. And I wrote a lot in my book too, right, about how I struggled with self-censorship when I was working on this topic of political taboo. And while studying a topic in exile, you find yourself in exile too. So, and behind that self-censorship, the way that authoritarian intimidation works is because behind that invisible lie you try not to cross, it was the things that you really care about. If your family, it's your love for your family members, right? So that's why we always didn't want to cross that invisible lie. And I think it also happened to both the younger generation and to their parents, who did not want to tell them anything about 1989, because it's just parents' nature that they want to protect their kids and they do not want them to have anything to do with politics. So it's a long narrative to answer your short question about how 1989 is affected all these mentalities and thinking. And I think when the whole society have to pretend that when something like this big happened, and then you have to tell yourself it did not happen, it's not important. It already caused all kind of trauma that we don't, we experienced such a tragic event in our youth. We were not even allowed to shed a tear or light a candle for the dead, and we were not even allowed to express anger and fear. And I think the Chinese society has been carrying this open, unhealed wound for 25 years. And if it doesn't, if truth and reconciliation, without truth there will be no reconciliation, and China would not be able to move on if they do not, if it refuses to face this. So it has to face its past in order to have a future.
Yes.
I'm a Beijing-based NGO worker. Our organization is a public interest law organization, so I just want to raise a question about the rule of law in China. I have a feeling of the rule of law, current rule of law in China. We have a hopeless new leadership on rule of law issue. But we have a hopeful civil society on rule of law subject. I'd like to provide an example related with the 25th anniversary of June 4th. It happened in Zhengzhou. Many activists organized an event for June 4th anniversary in February, and so after that, several of them were detained, and a very famous public interest lawyer based in Zhengzhou, named Chang Guoyang, represented some of them, and so he went to the detention center for a meeting, but was refused again and again, then he himself was detained, yeah, for the same reason, the same crime, disturbing the public order, yeah. And it's not the only case happening before June 4th. Another, the same situation happened in Beijing. Hu Zhixiang's lawyer was detained after he represented Hu Zhixiang. So after these two cases happened, many lawyers declared that they are willing to represent for lawyer Chang Boyang. And his lawyer went to Zhengzhou for a meeting and was refused. After that, 30 lawyers went to Zhengzhou, mm-hmm. organizing a seminar on this issue, on this case. Mm-hmm. And 20 of them went to the detention center, went to the PSB, and protest for the refusal. And then they forced the PSB to come out to meet and negotiate with them. So it's very influential on civil social media in China. And so I'm just here, working for this case. I'm also for this case, and I have brought some press release outside. And if you are interested in this case, you can have a look. And so I think through this case, I found there is a new trend in May. Lawyers were detained for their client case, criminally detained. It's very rare in the past, because in the past, government, of course, they dislikes human rights lawyers representing, but they usually punish them with administrative punishment, like disbarred, annual inspection. But this time, two lawyers were criminally detained for their client's case. So it's a very bad trend. I think if this trend cannot be stopped, the rule of law will be even worse than before. But fortunately, the civil society, the lawyers community, is very active. They have taken very strong action against the new trend. So I have the feeling, I just mentioned. And my question is, what do you think about the future of the rule of law in China? And I'd like to listen. Would you like to provide some comments?
I think what Mr. Liu just said, it's both gives us hope and it's very depressing. These are the two major pieces of news. Everybody who is connected to the Chinese human rights community waking up this morning are reading. One is this protests outside the Zhengzhou detention center where 20-plus lawyers are staging because they have been systematically prevented from meeting their clients, including Mr. Chang Boyang, the lawyer who went to defend detainees who gathered to commemorate June 4th in February. And then also a lawyer detained because she was involved in defending the case of Pu Zhixiang, who was himself a lawyer and been detained with a dozen of people. Right now, the others were released, and he remains detained and facing formal charges. So it's depressing to read about the news, but at the same time, where did we read about them? On Chinese social media. And how many news we're getting? A lot. And a lot of people are posting, reposting, are talking about this and said how horrible it is, what a violation of Chinese law, and what a kind of desecration of the leader's own vow to reform the legal system. So all these discussions coming with those cases, I think he himself basically answered the question about the rule of law in China. It's basically the reform is going, a few steps forward and a few steps back, and it's because the regime knows you cannot be serious about rule of law reform. If they really let law to rule the country, then they have to fold. The Communist Party has to go out of business. So practically...
Is that a wish expression?
So it's those brave lawyers who have been educated in law schools and taught about rule of law. And then they go into society, they say, rule by the party. So how did those things put, you know, how do you put them together? So they're fighting. They're fighting case by case, you know, saying, we want rule of law. And that's the hope. But then at the same time, if that party rule does not fold, close down for business, there's no real rule of law. There's no future for rule of law. Because it's a party rule. One-party rule in China.
Can I say we've run out of time, and we're going to have to end this. I would ask any of our panelists if they want to have a sort of final word before we close. Orville, any?
Well, I think that a Leninist system is basically and fundamentally opposed to any meaningful rule of law. It's hardly surprising that we've arrived at this impasse.
Yeah. Rowena?
I think Milan Kundera has said this very eloquently. The struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. If there's nothing we can do, I think at least we would remember, we shall remember and support those who remember. And that's the power of the powerless. That's our power. Thank you.
Sharon?
I think the Communist Party knows very well it has no legal, moral legitimacy, and it's ruling by fear. As we have seen today, you know, all these examples and all the points we have made is about the government is very, very insecure, and it's a striking fear to suppress memory of the Tiananmen, suppress information, suppress public participation in democratic reform and legal reform. So all this, I think, should give us confidence of what, you know, all you and you have been doing all these years. And even though we haven't seen the final result, but it's coming, and the incremental results are there. And we just have to have confidence, have faith, and keep up with our efforts and with all of your, whatever you can do to support democratization, human rights, not only in China, all over the world.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I want to make my own sort of last comment, which is that as dire as the situation is today, I count myself on the optimistic side for this reason, that there are so many persons in China who are struggling in one way or another to open up the system, and they are up against a very powerful state, a very powerful party, and a state and a party that have had great successes. But the fact that the state and the party have not wiped out that resistance to state repression gives me the possibility of remaining an optimist about the situation in China. Anyway, thank you very much.